Obviously, your real feelings have to come out somewhere, right? It's your brain's way of telling you that you're repressing something. She had almost made Sloane believe it. Regardless of what else she had seen underwater, she had gone to a place where the universes touched. Earth and Genetrix were connected. Nero hadn't lied about that. Which meant they still had to help Genetrix to help Earth. And they had already brought down one maniacal mass murderer. They would use the same strategy to do it again. That meant her job was to lure the resurrectionist into the open. She would walk along Congress Parkway until it passed beneath the old main post office, where he and his army had their lair. She would have to go alone, but the army of Flickering would follow her after she had made contact. She had done this before. She had gone alone to the Irv Cupsinet Bridge to be bait for the Dark One on Earth. She knew too well the feeling of numbness that took over. If not for seeing the toes of her boots digging into the rubble, she might not have known that she was still on the ground. But she kept moving now, just as she had before. She knew the path through the destruction of the drain site. City officials had spent the last 2 months clearing it. But it was still a mess of broken bricks and cracked boards, and bodies retrieved from basements. People of all walks of life picked their way through the wreckage, looking for the bodies of lost loved ones. Sloane wished that she could tell them not to bother. Their loved ones were likely in pieces. Drain victims almost always were. The cloak she wore was one of Aelia's, heavy and dark. Flakes of snow from a late spring cold front drifted through the light cast by emergency lamps, melting as soon as they touched the ground. Sloane's fingers were frozen even though they were clutching the folds of the cloak. She had insisted on wearing her own clothes beneath it, her Albi funeral blacks, the ones she had worn when she first surfaced on Genetrix. She reached the other end of the drain site, her boots coated in dust. She walked a block west, then started to cross the same bridge she had hobbled over with a broken ankle weeks ago. Ever since then, she had been dreaming, not of the Dark One, but of the Resurrectionist. They weren't nightmares, though, just a playback of their brief conversation, over and over, the same thing every time. "You aren't being fair. You and your friends come to kill me, and I'm not allowed to fight back." She had been tasked with studying the deaths of the other chosen ones summoned from other worlds. Despite Nero's promise to be more forthcoming, however, he and Aelia were still protective of the little information they had, dishing it out in small morsels. It was like having only a few pieces to a puzzle, and none of them fit together. All of them gave her questions that Nero and Aelia refused to answer. Sloane didn't like it. Moreover, she didn't trust it. "This world, your world, they destroy themselves. All worlds do. They don't need me," the Resurrectionist had said. He hadn't seemed like the Dark One. Not a parallel version of him or the man himself. Another piece she couldn't fit anywhere. Sloane stopped in the middle of the bridge and looked out over the water. She didn't know what to think. She didn't know if the Resurrectionist was the Dark One under the siphons and the dramatic cloak, or if the Resurrectionist was causing the drains, or how many chosen ones had died doing exactly what she was about to do. So she needed to find out. She started walking again. Standing in the alley between the old main post office and the building next to it, the Chicago Central Carrier Annex, she had looked it up. Sloane found the window she had jumped out of when she'd escaped from the Resurrectionist. It didn't look high now, weeks later, but it was too high for her to climb without any assistance. She wrapped a scarf around her face so only her eyes were uncovered, and checked her hood to make sure it was secure. Her cloak looked too fine to belong to one of the Resurrectionists' tattered army, but there wasn't anything she could do about that. She rounded the edge of the building in search of an entrance. Just off Harrison Street was a metal door with a push handle. The handle had a lock built into it. Good, she thought. Not a deadbolt. Sloane hunted along the ground for something to use as a hammer. She had to go back into the alley, but she finally found a large hunk of concrete, so wide she could hardly get her hand around it. It would have to do. Holding the concrete in both hands, she slammed it against the handle of the door. The door shuddered, and Sloane hit the handle again and again and again. Flecks of concrete broke off the hunk she held, and she gouged deep scratches into the metal door. Sloane kept hitting the handle until it broke off and dangled from the door by its inner mechanisms. She forced the door open and walked into what appeared to be an old loading bay. Dilapidated equipment filled the space, all of it rusted and covered in a thick layer of dust. There were conveyor belts and chutes, rotten pallets and ladders, bins large enough to hold a grown man that rolled on busted wheels. Sloane tried to affect the loping, shuffling gait she had seen from the undead man and woman who had first brought her here. She had gone in through the back, but the Resurrectionists' army might still be lurking somewhere nearby. She found the inner door of the loading bay and stepped into a worn hallway with a warped floor. Broken planks of wood had burst through the maroon carpet, and chunks of wall and ceiling were piled in her path. She stepped around them like she was playing hot lava with Cameron in their living room. Everything that wasn't maroon carpet was lava. As she walked, she tried to map out the building in her mind. She turned a corner and slipped into the emergency stairwell. So far, everything was quiet. She climbed two flights of stairs to get to the level where she had broken the window and jumped. Her ankle was still weak from that day, but the siphon had done its work, speeding the healing of her bones. Soon she arrived at the threshold of the dilapidated office where she had found the mattress and siphon parts. The Resurrectionist's living space, or so it appeared. She was still confused by the floral sheets that covered the mattress. They seemed comically out of place. She removed her heavy cloak. It would only get in her way, and she didn't need to hide who she was any longer. She took her tactical knife out of its sheath at her hip, crept into the space, and crouched beside one of the built-in desks behind the cubicle wall. Then, she waited for the Resurrectionist to return. Matt and Esther would be angry if they knew she was deviating from their plan. Maybe they would even hate her for it. But really, Sloane thought, they ought to have been suspicious when she agreed to be bait again. Besides, she wasn't necessarily abandoning the plan entirely. She was just changing its timeline. She waited. Her heartbeat still hadn't slowed when she heard footsteps in the hallway. But no voices. He was alone. The door opened, and she heard his heavy breaths, the rustle of fabric around him. She tipped her head back just enough to see his hood over the low wall that surrounded the desk. And then she stood, stepped around the wall, and lunged. She yanked his hood off with one hand and brought the knife up to his throat with the other, holding him by his hair, which was dark and long for a man, and pressed the blade in just enough for him to feel how sharp it was. "Hi there," she said. She could feel the warmth of him, the life in him. She had known that he was human, but part of her had wondered if he was the same as his army. More dust than man. His breaths came fast through the siphon, crackling. "Keep your hands still," she said. She held the knife above the siphon that covered his throat. But with her free hand, she reached down to undo the clasp of the siphon around his wrist. It was too strange, her skin brushing his as she felt for the release and tugged it. The siphon dropped, heavy, to the floor. She switched knife hands so she could do the same to his other wrist. She was conscious of her breaths, which were just like his, fast and loud. Everything sounded muffled. He had almost killed Kyros in front of her with just a whistle. What else could he do before she could stop him? And here she stood with a tactical knife like an idiot. "Should have known you'd come back." His voice came out tinny, warped by the siphon. "True hero and all. Your kind do tend to go on ill-advised suicide missions." Sloane laughed harshly. "Your assumptions about my character are so off base, it's actually hilarious," she said. "I'm not here to kill you. If I were, I'd have slit your throat already. Because I'm also not here to die." He held his hands out from his sides. They were big and pale, with oddly delicate knuckles. "Slitting my throat immediately would have been smarter," he said. "As much as I wanted to, that would kind of defeat the purpose of my being here." "I came for a trade," she said. "Truth for truth." "Truth," he repeated. "I'm not even sure what that is anymore." "Please, for the love of God, don't be one of those villains who waxes poetic about existentialist nonsense. Because if you are, I really will have to cut you," she said. "How about we start with this? Who the hell are you?" "You don't already know." When she didn't answer, he lifted his hands slowly up to his face. Sloane kept the press of her knife steady. He undid the latches of the siphon that covered his eyes and pulled it away. She saw his reflection in the windows across from them, but only faintly. Just the paleness of him and his shape against the dark. He was still as she moved around him, his hands up, palms facing forward. His wrists were scarred from siphons, the kind of marks worn into skin day after day for years. His nose and mouth were still covered, but his eyes were dark and focused and familiar. She laughed. "Mox?" she said. "So I take it you didn't just happen upon me in the cultural center that day." He undid the latches of his mouth siphon too, then wiped his chin of sweat. He set both siphons down on the desk beside him. He looked worse than he had the last time she'd seen him. Wan, dark circles under his eyes, sweaty, young. "I gave you your truth," he said. And his voice was different than she remembered it from the cultural center or the tankard. Rougher. "Now give me mine." Sloane saw something unsteady in him that she hadn't seen when she knew him only as Mox. A kind of agitation that would have been frightening if she had not known it so well herself. He was afraid. And for him, for both of them, fear was always anger and demand. "No," she said. "I didn't ask you for your name. I asked you who you are. Are you the Dark One? In some kind of disguise?" "The what?" Mox said, and his confusion didn't clear up anything. Sloane was trying to keep her breath steady, but they kept coming out in little bursts. She didn't know. She didn't know if she was standing across from the Dark One or someone just as bad. A murderer, a psychopath, an evil sorcerer. She had no idea what Mox was. "I had an enemy," she said. "I thought I killed him, but he came here instead, And I want to know. I need to know if you're him. If I tell you that I'm not, he said, you won't believe me. And I'm not giving you anything else until you make good on our trade. She had trusted her gut before, when she had just gone through puberty and her body had taken a new shape. She had known when there were eyes on her, when a man's kindness was a threat. When Katie McKinney had offered her a red cup of something at the one party she had gone to before leaving town. She had known not to drink it because there was spit in it. And at the end of the struggle with the Dark One, she had known to use the Dark One's interest in her against him. I would know, she thought. I would know if I was standing in front of the Dark One. I would feel it. They're coming for you, Nero and my friends, she said. I was supposed to lure you out to Congress Parkway. I came here instead. His eyes widened. Nero? He's with them? You're sure? Yes? He grabbed the siphon he had set on the desk and pressed it roughly to his face, covering his nose and mouth. Then he bent over to pick up the wrist siphons Sloane had let fall to the floor. Hey, we are not done with this conversation. Mox looked up at her from where he was crouched, reattaching one of his wrist siphons. He whistled and waved a bare hand at her, and the knife crumpled in her hands like a snowball, the pieces scattered on the worn carpeting. Fuck, Sloane snapped. Really? We can continue this discussion, he said, voice tinny again. But I can't let Nero get anywhere near this building while I'm still in it. What? She thought of Nero's workshop, packed with books, and of his floppy blonde hair. He must be highly skilled with magic, or he wouldn't have been able to orchestrate their summoning from another universe. But he didn't seem nearly as threatening as the Resurrectionist. Mox stood and attached the eye siphons, transforming again into the creature he had been. I will tell you, he said, offering her a metal-plated hand. But you'll have to come with me. And though Sloane knew it was madness to choose this man, this masked murderer who kept company with the dead, over Matt and Esther, over Nero and Aelia, even, she also knew that it was already decided, and had been since she broke into this building. She put her hand in his. If she died because of this, well, at least it was a death she chose. Chapter 31. Mox led her down the hall with the checkerboard tile floor and the tall boarded windows she had seen when she had first regained consciousness. It was as crowded with soldiers now as it had been then. They walked past a group of them crouched around a few scattered dice, and a pair stitching each other's fingers back on with a needle and thread. The woman with the hole in her jaw marched toward them. Her stringy hair was in two braids now, a girlish style that was at odds with her discolored skin. She stared at Sloane. Sir, the woman said. What? She came to warn us, Mox interrupted. We need to leave. Get everyone up into the safe house. The woman leaned in closer to Sloane, her teeth clicking together as she clenched her jaw. Sloane watched her tongue work behind them before she spoke, in the same raspy, strained voice Sloane remembered. Are you sure she's not setting a trap? I don't believe she has that level of foresight, Mox replied. Fuck you, Sloane said. Over the woman's shoulder, she spotted the milky-eyed man who had carried her into the building over his shoulder. He was sitting with a few others, a siphon in pieces in his lap. He made a kissing face at her. I didn't mean in general, Mox told Sloane, sounding a little like the normal young man she had met in the cultural center, even through the metallic warp of his siphon. Sloane, this is Ziva, my lieutenant. Ziva, Sloane. We've met, Sloane said. She chloroformed me. We thought you were some great magic user, Ziva said, her upper lip curling in what might have been a sneer if her lips hadn't been taut and cracked, like dry earth. If I'd known you were completely helpless, I wouldn't have bothered. Helpless? Sloane laughed. So how do you explain me escaping from right under your nose? This building is about to be stormed by the army of Flickering, but by all means, continue arguing like children, Mox snapped. Ziva stood up straighter, then stepped away from Sloane and Mox. She stuck a whistle, attached to one of her fingers, between her lips, and blew on it. Sloane brought a hand to her chest to steady herself when all the soldiers in the hallway got to their feet. It took some of them longer than others. Sloane watched a smaller woman slump against the wall and then shove herself up with both legs as a lever. When the woman turned, Sloane saw that she was holding an arm, one that had clearly once gone in her shoulder socket. Ziva whistled again, bringing her hand up to her throat, where she wore a scratched siphon. Her voice came out twice as loud, though still raspy. Emergency evac! To the safe house, and keep your eyes open. We're being pursued. Ziva looked over her shoulder at Sloane, and there was something odd in her expression. Something like hope and despair mixed together. Still can't use a siphon, Mox said to Sloane. All around them, the soldiers of the Resurrectionist had picked up bags and were stuffing things, including, Sloane noticed, the woman's detached arm into them. No, Sloane admitted. Then you're stuck with me at the front, he said. Better keep up. The army was forming a loose pack behind them. Someone pried the boards away from one of the doors, letting in a gust of fresh air. The blue geometric fixtures above Sloane's head swung back and forth in the wind. Mox loped toward the doors, his gait uneven but powerful, his cloak whipping around his shoulders. She felt the soldiers behind her creeping closer and ran to catch up with him. She had left her own cloak behind, so the cold air cut right through her shirt, sending a shiver through her. She pulled her sleeves down over her hands. Behind her, the Resurrectionist's army spilled into the street like a glass of water tipped over. They divided into smaller groups, silent except for the creaking of their bones and the shuffling of their feet. They disappeared down alleys and slipped between buildings, peeling away with every side street they passed, until it was just Mox, Sloane, and a trio of decrepit undead. The streets were emptier here, south of downtown, and the buildings were farther apart. They passed a corner store, lit up by pale fluorescents displaying a dozen brands of cigarettes. Rabdos, fairy godmothers, and Fumus among them. And liters of soda in green, orange, and glittery blue. Behind the counter, a sallow-faced man gaped at them as they passed. Even shrouded in hoods and cloaks, as all the others were, they still made a strange sight. Four hooded figures with siphon hands outstretched, and one random woman making their way down the sidewalk. A few cars passed, swerving away from them as if they were potholes, but their path was unobstructed until they reached Roosevelt Road. To the left was the train yard, the ground rippling with rails, and parked at the corner on the right was a police car. Though the vehicle's lights were off, Sloane saw two silhouettes in the front seats. Mox stuck out a hand, and they all came to a halt. He let out a tweet like a sparrow. Behind him, the undead soldiers stretched out their own siphon arms and bit down on whistles. In unison, all four magic users made the same sound at the same pitch, high and light, a chorus of birdsong. The police car lifted off the pavement and turned upside down. Sloane saw the officers inside it shifting, and then one thrust a hand against the glass, showing the unmistakable palm plate of a standard-issue siphon. Mox whistled again. The car righted itself and touched down on the street like it had never moved at all. A chorus of dissonant sounds surrounded Sloane. She clapped her hands over her ears. The car's tire spun backward, sending it over the rails, through the barrier, and into the Chicago River. Sloane stared at Mox. He began walking again, and the others followed him. They traveled in silence over the water, then turned to walk along it. They passed gutters full of paper and half-crushed soda cans. Sloane kicked a rotting apple core out of her way. She was numb with terror and just as afraid of the army of Flickering finding them as she was of the man who had just drowned two police officers. Ahead of them, Sloane spotted dark figures. A shout rang out. There was a flash of fire, and in the orange light, Sloane saw the seal of the army of Flickering on one man's jacket. "Ziva!" Mox shouted, so loud the sound crackled in his mask. He ran. The wall of fire cast by the army of Flickering danced toward hunch shapes that Sloane recognized as Ziva, the lieutenant, and four other undead soldiers. Ziva and one of the other soldiers whistled together, and ice formed at their feet, piling on itself until it had formed a knee-high barrier of icicles that reflected fractured moonlight. Mox reached them, and he swept the soldiers off their feet with a low rumble. They landed hard on their knees on the street. Mox shouted instructions at Ziva that Sloane couldn't hear. An arc of energy, almost like a bubble of air, swept toward him. It pushed him back, toward the river, and up, at least 6 feet in the air. Mox fell hard on his back, but as soon as he hit the ground, he thrust his arm up and let out a peal of percussive sound. Chunks of pavement pulled away from the edge of the road and hurtled toward the soldiers. They threw up shimmering barriers of energy, and the rocks pummeled them but didn't break through. Mox turned to Ziva and shouted, "Go!" Ziva hesitated, and Mox whistled, sending a hiss of air toward her so intense it blew the hood off her head. She ran, followed by the four undead soldiers under her command. Mox turned his attention back to the soldiers of the army of Flickering, who had let down their barriers in the wake of the rock assault and were, together, raising water from the river. At the gesture of the lead woman, the water formed a massive orb the size of a car. It had no sooner taken shape than it enveloped Mox completely. The orb warped and rotated almost as soon as it hit him, and then he was in the center of a cyclone, his hair clinging to his masked face and his soaked clothes whipping around his shoulders. The cyclone chewed up pavement as it charged at the soldiers, flinging rocks and water in equal measure at them. As one of the soldiers cringed away from the onslaught, Sloane recognized her as Edda. Their eyes met just as Mox raised his hand again. Sloane shouted, "Don't!" Mox hesitated and it cost him. Edda whistled, sharp and clean, and something silver shot through the air at him, a large fragment of metal that stabbed his side. His body hunched around it. He screamed through the siphon, and the next moment let out a long, keening note. Daybright light exploded from his hand. Sloane threw an arm up over her eyes to shield them, but this was no momentary flash. She felt a continued heat against her forearm that meant the light was still burning. The Flickering soldiers were shouting at one another. A hand wrapped around her elbow, Keep your arm up, Mox said to her. Let's go. He steered her away from the flickering soldiers, barked a command at the undead ones trailing them, and they ran. Cordis Daily, The Bulletin Board, Meeting Place of Magical Youth, by Sarah Romanoff.
Chicago, November 3rd. If I have an idea for a working I can't do on my own, Alyssa, 17, says as she staples a piece of paper to the bulletin board in Palmer Square Park, I just put up a request for an assembly. You can specify ages, too, so I always do 18 or under. We don't want any strange old men spoiling the fun. Alyssa's current assembly request? For a timed levitation. Her request is for 5 people, each with an object they would like to levitate, to meet in Palmer Square Park in 2 days' time, objects in hand. Together, they will set up a timed working for the next morning, at which point all their objects will levitate at once. Timed workings always require at least one other person, one to do the working and one to set the timer, Alyssa says. So they're the most common thing you see on here. Also glowing. People are deeply interested in making things glow these days. For most of us, assemblies, the term for a group of magic users convening for a single working, were integral to our magical education. But in the past, assemblies were arranged by school staff, and they had to be supervised by a teacher. Now, students are taking their learning into their own hands, meeting freely and with young people from other schools, even other cities. I drove all the way to Indianapolis for one once, says Josh, 16, from Buffalo Grove, Illinois. I told my mom it was for a concert, and I did go to a concert, but I also went to the group working. We built a rain cloud. Some people did the illusion of a cloud, some did the water, one did lightning strikes, and one did thunder. Some parents, naturally, are concerned. What if they do something dangerous? Asks Ellen Higgins, founder of Parents of Teens Under Control, PODUC, a community action group that seeks out unsupervised group workings and interrupts them. They can't just run around doing magic without anybody knowing. They could really hurt themselves, so we won't let that happen. When I ask Alyssa about PODUC, she just rolls her eyes. We have to use code in our messages now, she says. I won't tell you what it is, but my next assembly is going to be supervised, so PODUC can't spoil it.
Chapter 32. By the time that Sloane's vision cleared, they were inside the safe house, a large red brick building perched on the river's edge. The space looked like it had once been elegant, but had fallen into disrepair. The ceiling was wood paneled, with skylights in a squared arch that let in the glow of the moon. As with the old main post office, the lower windows were boarded up. But judging by the position of the building on the river, she was sure that the view would have been of a stretch of skyline. Crowded inside the space were the groups of the Resurrectionists' army that had arrived before them. Ziva wandered among them, distinguished by the braids swinging back and forth against her shoulders. When Mox walked in, he released Sloane's arm and hunched over the piece of metal buried in his side to give it a closer look. Don't go yanking that out, Sloane said. Not until you can clean the wound and pack it. Mox looked at her, or he seemed to, turning the mechanized siphon eyes in her direction for a moment. Then we'll have to wait, he said. Stay here. He loped across the dusty wood floor to Ziva's side. Sloane leaned against one of the wood pillars at the edge of the room and watched as he worked his way through the crowd of soldiers, clapping them on the shoulder or bending his ear to them. The woman who had carried her arm in a bag took it out when he came near her and showed it to him. Sloane was surprised when he knelt beside her and took something from his pocket. A leather packet about the size of his palm that, when opened, revealed a needle and some kind of thick thread. Sloane watched with mixed revulsion and fascination as he began to stitch the arm back on. The woman held it in place as he did so, watching the skin split around the point of the needle, the string tugging through gently and then pulling taut. When he finished, he tied off the string and gestured over the sutures. Sloane assumed it was some kind of working, but she couldn't tell what it did. Regardless, the undead woman touched the side of Mox's head fondly and smiled. Sloane had assumed that the resurrectionist's undead army was enthralled to him, a mindless collection of zombie slaves. But it seemed clear now that they knew him. Perhaps they had even known him before they died. It was a while before he returned to her, still with the metal embedded in his side, all his clothes damp from the flickering soldier's attempt to drown him. "We have food and water stowed elsewhere," he said. Sloane followed him out of the room. She knew she should be afraid to be alone with him, to be here at all. But it was too late to go back now. She had betrayed her friends. Etta had seen her with the resurrectionist. They went into a smaller room not far from the others, still in a state of disrepair. A crumbling half wall separated it from a bathroom, and there were cobwebs in the exposed rafters of the ceiling, but swept clean and stocked neatly with cans of food and jugs of water. There was a pile of blankets in the corner, too, and a small table with two rickety chairs set up around it. Mox stood before the table and started removing his siphons. The wrists came first, then mouth, eyes, and ear. Beneath them, his skin was sweat-slicked and pale. "I'm not your nurse," Sloane said. "Didn't ask you to be," Mox replied. But she still picked up one of the water jugs and set it on the table in front of him, then searched the row of supplies for a first aid kit. When she found one, she dropped it next to the water jug, which she opened and gulped from greedily. Mox sat down in one of the chairs, heavily enough to make it creak, and reached for the little box with trembling fingers. "Is that metal serrated?" she said, nodding to the fragment just above his hip. "No. Edge looks straight. Did it hit bone?" Mox plucked a pair of scissors from the kit and cut from the hem of his shirt to the shard, then pulled the fabric away from the wound. It looked nasty, blood streaking his pale skin beneath the puncture, the tip of the blade, or whatever it was, sticking out behind him. But he had been lucky. It seemed to have gone through the meat of his hip, missing bone and organs both. "Looks like you might be able to just pull it out," Sloane said. Mox grunted in reply. "I guess I could help," she said, "in exchange for some answers." "Not sure where to begin," he said. "How about you start with why you stalked me to the cultural center?" she said. She was hesitant about stepping closer, but she forced herself to do it, then searched through the first aid kit for antiseptic. She would have to sterilize the wound as best she could with the metal still in it, then pull it out and apply pressure to staunch the bleeding. She had done it before. Inez had gotten pierced with debris during a drain once. But it felt different this time, in the quiet, with no battle raging around her. "Ziva noticed something going on at the camel. All the scurrying around. So I knew they had summoned another one. There's a burst of energy when they do it." His face twitched a little. "If you're paying attention, you can feel it for miles in every direction. Like a bubble of magic popping. And I'd been waiting for it." "You said that you knew they had summoned another one," she said. "Another what, exactly?" She poured water from the jug over the wound to clean off some of the blood. then doused the entry point and exit point of the wound in antiseptic. That would have to do. Mox was unwrapping a square of gauze. They bring warriors here from other places to fight me. You, your friends, are the fourth. He offered her the gauze, and she took it, and clamped it around the metal so she could get a firm and clean grip on it. Fourth, she said. Nero said we were the fifth chosen ones they'd brought here. Chosen ones. Mox's brow furrowed. I'm going to pull now, she said. Unless you'd like to do it magically. He snorted. I would probably cut myself in half if I tried. Fair enough. Brace yourself. Mox grabbed the edge of the table, and Sloane pinched the flat of the shard between thumb and forefinger on both hands. She took a deep breath and pulled as hard as she could. Mox screamed, stuffing his fist into his mouth to muffle the sound. The fragment moved, but only a little. Without delaying, she pulled again, and this time the metal pulled free. She set it aside. Mox was trembling, but trying to open another packet of gauze. She smacked his hands away and did it herself, then used the gauze to apply pressure to both sides of the wound. Yeah, she said, picking up where their conversation had left off. Who did you think they were summoning? Random mercenaries? They've all been chosen ones. People who have defeated some kind of evil figure in their own worlds. Mox's eyes were unfocused, likely from the pain when he blinked up at her. I didn't know, he said. At first I tried to talk to them, but they wouldn't stop. His face went blank, so I killed them instead. Fear prickled in Sloane's chest, but a moment later, Mox blinked, and his expression changed. It was almost like he had come back to the surface of his own mind. You could have hurt me in the cultural center, she said, and then again in the tankard, but you didn't. I didn't know how many of you there were or what I would be up against, Mox said. I always wanted to know why they wanted me dead, these warriors from other worlds. Wanted to know what was in it for them. But isn't it obvious why they wanted you dead? She swallowed hard. Maybe it wasn't wise to press him on this issue, but she had to. The drain. They wanted to stop the drain. As I said before, he replied, looking up at her. I suppose I should be flattered that you think I could cause that level of destruction by myself, but I can't. So the drains, they aren't you. Mox shook his head. Who controls them then? Nobody knows, he said. But my theory is they're a natural phenomenon. A byproduct, you might say, of the connection between universes. No, they aren't. Here, take this. Sloane waited until his hand had replaced hers on the gauze, then fumbled with the contents of the first aid kit, looking for a bandage. All she could find was a packet made of stiff plastic. The Dark One, the evil figure in my world, the one we defeated, caused drains all the time. They stopped once he was gone. Mox's hand stilled hers. He took the packet from her and flicked it open. What fell from it was a long, flat siphon, like the one the doctor had attached to her broken ankle. It looked like a bracelet with wide, flat metal links. Plain, unpolished, but still elegant. Mox held it over his hip, removed the gauze he was using to staunch the bleeding, and placed the siphon over the entry and exit wounds both. It stops bleeding, deters infection, and speeds healing, he said, almost as if he were reciting something he had read in a textbook or an ad. Sloane frowned at the strip of pale skin still visible over the waistband of his pants. You can't be saying the Dark One didn't cause our drains. He was present at every single one of them, and they stopped when he disappeared. What else could it have been? Mox frowned back at her. I don't know everything that can be done with magic, he said. Especially across universes, dimensions. But I know what I can't do. And I know that I've never encountered anyone here as powerful as I am. Maybe your Dark One was. He shrugged. Unlikely. She snorted. Not suffering from a lack of confidence, are you? No. He replied. But he didn't sound boastful. Only sad. Not when it comes to raw power. I'm not. But there are more important things. You know that. It's how you escaped. He smirked a little. Very clever, by the way. Thanks, she said stiffly. Mox stood, using the table to steady himself, and went to a small cabinet in the corner of the room. Inside it was a small stack of clothes. All dark colors, of course. Because supposedly evil sorcerers who commanded armies of undead couldn't wander around in bright orange, after all. He took a shirt from the stack and limped into the bathroom behind the half wall to change. It's my turn, he said, for a question. Sloane sat in the other chair and started gathering the scraps of gauze and wrappers from her stint as nurse. Exactly what she had told him she wouldn't be. Not a good precedent to set, she knew. But it was already done. You said, when you were trapped, that you didn't choose to come here, he said. She could only see the back of his head and one of his shoulders over the crumbling wall. But the flash of bare skin made her feel uneasy. You mean when you kidnapped me and held me against my will? Sloane tilted her head. Yeah. Before I got pulled into Genetrix, I was in the middle of a funeral, and the next thing I knew, I was almost drowning in the Chicago River. And you weren't given a choice to return. No. Sloane almost sighed with relief when Mox came back into the room with a shirt on, his hair tied back in a low knot. They told us that the fate of our world and the fate of Genetrix were intertwined. And that we would need to fight the Resurrectionist. I mean, you. If we wanted to save them both. Mox stared at her for a moment. His shoulders started to shake. For a single horrifying moment, Sloane thought he was sobbing. And then she saw he was laughing, holding one hand against the wound in his side. My God, Mox said, sounding almost giddy. This is what I meant. What's more important than raw power? Elegant lies, that's what. So, Sloane narrowed her eyes. Earth's and Genetrix's fates aren't intertwined? Mox flapped a hand at her. Not that part. The part about me. Fighting me. Killing me. As if you could. As if it would help anything at all. First of all, if I had decided to stab you in the jugular instead of having a conversation earlier, I would have totally been able to kill you, Sloane said. Magic is great and all, but you're still just a sack of meat at the end of the day. Mox spread his hands, big even without the siphons to add bulk to them, in acknowledgement. Second, what's the point of all this? She said. Why do they want you dead so badly they would take people from another dimension but they won't go after you themselves? Not they. He. Mox said, now agitated. He paced away from her. Nero. Nero? Sloane repeated. Not that I doubt you, but he seems kind of non-threatening. Are you sure he's... Am I sure? Mox spun on his heel and the pile of cans along the wall lifted from the floor all at once. They slammed into the ceiling, then flew in all directions. Sloane ducked as one rocketed toward her head. It hit the wall behind her and started leaking yellow juice. Both of them were breathless. Sloane with fear, and Mox, she assumed from his wild-eyed stare, with anger. "There's no need to have a fucking tantrum about it," she said. "All I've seen of Nero is that he's Aelia's lackey most of the time. Not exactly evil mastermind material. Especially compared to a guy who just attacked an innocent can of green beans." She picked the can up and slammed it on the table, the dented side facing him. "Raw power," Mox said, "isn't everything." "Clearly," she said, disguising the quiver in her hands by making fists. "He doesn't just do things," Mox said. He started pacing again. "He gets other people to do them for him. He's good at it. He's whoever you need him to be, whenever you need him to be it. Until suddenly, he's not anymore. He brought you here. Keeps bringing people here over and over to kill me. And if they fail, well, fine. It keeps everyone distracted from what he's doing. Either way, he wins." Sloane cast a net in her memories of Nero, trying to catch a single instance of what Mox was describing. But the only time she had seen him deviate from his affable persona was after she and Esther had broken into his workshop. His voice had been so cold. But that wasn't enough. "What is he doing?" she said quietly. "That he wants to distract everyone from." Mox's pacing slowed. "I'm not sure. But my guesses are working. Something that will make him more powerful than I am, than anyone is. Fill him with magic." The words reminded her of the Dark One, and how she had thought of him as no more than a mouth, devouring. That crafty as he was, the true horror of him was simple. Nothing, not magic, not pain, not power, would ever be enough. He ate just for the sake of eating. And there was no argument she could make to someone like that to get him to stop hurting Albie. To let them both go. To do anything other than what he wanted. She stared at her boots. Bare feet meant the past. Boots meant the present. She crossed her arms. "Do you have any proof?" Mox stopped pacing altogether and faced her. "Surely you understand why I can't just believe you," she said. "There has to be something other than your word that I can rely on." "I haven't killed you yet," he suggested. "Lots of people haven't killed me yet," Sloane replied. "That doesn't mean you're telling the truth about Nero." "Well," he said. "There's Sybil." "Sybil?" "The prophet. The one who made Genetrix's doomsday prophecy." He sat again across from her. He was so different now than he had been when she knew him only as Mox. He had been charming and level-headed then. No sign of the chaos beneath. She wondered how he had managed it, even for a few minutes at a time. He didn't seem capable of it now. "She knows who I am," he said. "She knows who Nero is. And she can tell you how the end will come." "Where is she?" "A haven city, where no magic can touch her. She hates it, the way it feels. Hates the way I feel too. But she'll bear it for an hour or two if I ask her to." He scratched the back of his neck, nails raking red lines into his pale skin. St. Louis. Does your world have a St. Louis? Sloane nodded. I can take you, he said. Tomorrow. Okay, she said. But no path of destruction, okay? No killing. We keep it quiet. I'll never apologize for defending my life, he said. His dark eyes finding hers with that focus that made Sloane feel like she was under a blowtorch. I'll never ask you to, she said. He gave her a peculiar look, like he had never heard such a thing before.
Excerpt from The Mammoth Treasury of Unrealist Poetry, Volume 4. A Message to Haven Cities After the Installation of Magical Dampeners, by Fakenbake. Haven Cities, we fix you in our gaze of judgment. Our gaze, a gaze, a walking stick, a steering wheel. We fix you in our gaze of judgment. Haven't you heard, haven't you, that it is illegal to swallow a person's magic and burp up mediocrity? You and your siphon dampener, your ball gag, your pacifier, your duct tape across the lips of your hostage citizens. We fix you. We cannot fix you. We fix ourselves. Floating castles, paper fireflies, frozen flames. We make the impossible possible. And full of possibilities, dampen us? No, we dampen you.
Chapter 33. Sloane woke the next morning with a start, then slid her hand underneath her pillow for the pair of scissors she had put there before falling asleep. She knew that scissors wouldn't do her any good against either ridiculously powerful sorcerers or walking corpses, as Mox had pointed out when he saw her take them. But she hated to be without tools. Ziva was crouched at her bedside. Her bulging eyes swiveled to the scissors, and she let out a huff that might have been a laugh. A humdrum girl in a magical world, Ziva wheezed. What are you going to do, trim my fingernails? Underestimating my resourcefulness didn't work out so great for you last time, Sloane said. Remember? Ziva sat back on her heels with another huff. The consul told me to give you these, she said, and she thrust a stack of clothes at Sloane. They looked like Mox's, which meant the pants would be long enough, at least. And to tell you there's soap in his bathroom if you want to try to shower with a jug of water. Your train is set to leave in 2 hours. The consul? Sloane said. Ziva cocked her head. Did you think we called him the Resurrectionist? I thought maybe you called him by his name. Ziva made a derisive noise, not through her nose, but with the suck of her tongue against her teeth. In order to stand, she had to move one of her legs with both hands and then shake out the other knee so it, too, straightened. Sloane wondered if the Resurrectionist's army had to oil their joints, like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. Sloane walked to Mox's room and bathroom, with the clothes tucked under her arm. Last night, she had carried a stack of blankets far away from the space where the army was housed to a corner near the stairwell, so she could make a quick exit if necessary. It had taken her a long time to fall asleep, not just because of the strange surroundings or the buzz of all that Mox had told her in the back of her mind, but also because of the guilt over abandoning Matt and Esther in the middle of a mission, without explanation. She had disappointed them in so many ways since they came to Genetrix. She wouldn't have blamed them if they never spoke to her again after this. But the lure of the truth had been too strong. If reading the FOIA documents had convinced her of anything, it was that she had gone on too many missions without knowing everything there was to know. She had never made an informed choice in all her life. Bert had taken advantage of the eagerness of her young mind, and Nero and Aelia had intended to do the same. But that wouldn't happen again. Mox wasn't in his room when Sloane entered, for which she was grateful. She stripped down in the bathroom, a jug of water at her side, and cleaned up the best she could, shuddering from the cold the whole time. Mox's pants were hopelessly long on her, so she wore her own. She put on his shirt but rolled up the sleeves so they bunched around her elbows. She was braiding her hair when he came in, his hand in the beat-up green siphon he had been wearing when she first met him. For a second, they just stared at each other, Sloane's fingers still tangled in her hair.